The first reading this morning comes from an observation by Bell Hooks, the pen name for Gloria Watkins. And this is from her book, Talking Back, in 1989.
This past semester, I taught a course on Black women writers, in which students were encouraged to think about the social context in which literature emerges, the impact of politics of domination, racism, sexism, class exploitation on the writing. Students stated quite openly and honestly that reading the literature in the context of class discussion was making them feel pain. They complained that everything was changing for them, that they were seeing the world differently, and seeing things in that world that were painful to face. Never before had a group of students so openly talked about the way in which learning to see the world critically was causing pain. I did not belittle their pain or try to rationalize it. Initially, I was uncertain about how to respond and just asked us all to think about it. Later, we discussed the way in which all their comments implied to experience pain is bad, an indication that something is wrong. We talked about changing how we perceive pain, about our society's approach to pain, considering the possibility that this pain could be a constructive sign of growth. I shared with them my sense that the experience should not be viewed as static, that at another point, the knowledge and new perspectives they had might lead to clarity and a greater sense of well-being.
The second reading this morning is from the 1999 book, Coercion, Why We Listen to What They Say, by Douglas Rushkoff. They say human beings use only 10% of their brains. They say polyunsaturated fat is better for you than saturated fat. They say that tiny squiggles in a rock prove there was once life on Mars. They say our children's test scores are declining. They say that Jesus was a direct descendant of King David. They say you can earn $15,000 a week in your spare time. They say marijuana leads to LSD, and LSD can lead to suicide. They say the corner office is always a position of power. They say that the elderly should get their flu shots this season. They say people can be hypnotized to do anything. They say people won't do anything under hypnosis that they won't do when conscious. They say Prozac alleviates depression. They say mutual funds are the best long-term investment. They say computers can predict the future. They say you haven't met your deductible. Who exactly are they, and why do they say so much? More amazing, why do we listen to them? We can each have our own theys, the bosses, experts, and authorities, both real and imagined, who seem to dictate our lives, decide our fates, and create our futures. In the best of circumstances, they can make us feel safe, the way parents do. They make our decisions for us. They do our thinking for us. We don't have to worry about our next move. It has already been decided on our behalf and in our best interests. Or so we hope. The justifiably cynical among us have come to expect this sort of treatment from the professional people in our lives. When we walk into a shopping mall, we understand that we will be subjected to certain forms of influence. We recognize that retail sales are the bottom line, and that to stay in business, shop owners depend upon our behaving in a predictable and somewhat malleable fashion.
If the thundercloud passes rain, so let it rain down on me. So
I, for one, had no idea about Mark Twain's later years until I read the story about him and his cat, Bambino, which I told you earlier this morning. Oh, I knew about his novels, as you do, one of which is considered by many critics, by most critics, to be the only other great American novel, along with Hawthorne's Moby Dick. What amazed me, however, was the story of his depression. After all, Twain was a humorist through and through, a laugh riot, a wit, brilliant. When I was in college and I read some of his essays, not his novels, like James Fenimore Cooper's Literary Offenses, I literally rolled around on the ground, unable to stop laughing, silent, laughing till I was silent, tears running down my red face. When he published his novel on Joan of Arc, I didn't know he did so deliberately anonymously because he told his publisher, "People are going to expect me to make them laugh. And there's nothing funny about the Maid of Orleans. So best not to use my name." But sadly, he experienced a lot of death in a very short time. One of his daughters from a disease. His beloved wife and the editor of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. And a very good friend of his also. And so for a long time, he just walked around in his bathrobe and stayed indoors, sad as can be. Now, I am not the funniest guy in the world like Twain was. But although I am usually pretty upbeat, I too have undergone bouts of depression in my life. Most of us have at one time or another. I'm not talking about the kind of depression here that some people fight, which is more a part of their whole system from birth. I'm talking about situational and circumstantial depression. I had a good bout of it around New Year's, the day after New Year's especially. I just couldn't get out of bed. The toll of grief for recent deaths in my life, suppressed during the holidays, just kept me in that bed. Now, I wasn't afraid of this depression, this immense sadness, knowing that it was going to pass eventually. They usually do. But on that day in particular, I was completely paralyzed. At the end of the day, however, as I lie there in my bed, a friend of mine called. I said hello, and he said, "Can you say something to cheer me up?" He was wrestling with job issues, career goals. He had just quit his job because they weren't giving him enough hours to even pay his rent. Could I offer some words to cheer him up? That's what he said. We talked on the phone for about 5 minutes, and I realized it was not the kind of conversation that was best on the phone. So I said, how about if I come over and we go out for coffee and we talk face to face for a while? He agreed, and so I got dressed and I got into my car and I went down to Grove City where he lives, and I met him at a coffee shop around 7:15. At 10 o'clock, we closed the coffee shop down. We had been talking that whole time, and then we went back to his house and we talked till 2. Not just about jobs, but about everything. When I left, he was no longer depressed, no longer concerned about his jobs and career goals. And I wasn't depressed either, although I had not ever told him that I was. We influenced each other, even though that is not what we were trying to do. We were just talking. But the influence was real and effective, just as it was with Mr. Twain. All of those children coming to his door to offer him their care. All those kind notes he received. Here, take my cat. Borrow it. And the next thing you know, Mr. Twain is dressed in his famous white suit and walking openly down the streets of New York on Fifth Avenue and greeting people with his famous smile. I'd wager that we probably don't know how much we influence each other by just being there, just showing up, just saying hello, just shaking a hand. When I go for coffee in the morning down on a place on High Street, Eric, the guy behind the counter, always comes around the counter, shakes my hand, welcomes me. I feel welcomed. I feel like I'm seen. It's wonderful. Just listening to a story. Even just taking a walk with someone quietly. Influence, mutual influence for the good. We impact each other every day in ways we are not aware of. But as Douglas Rushkoff pointed out rather well, it's possible to influence each other in different ways too. For example, if you heard me say in a class here at the church on the New Testament, they say Jesus was a direct descendant of King David. It's in that reading that Rushkoff writes. You may be influenced to trust me that that's a true statement when I say it, because some of you know that I taught New Testament for many years, well over a decade, at one of our seminaries. It's my expertise, actually. But you would be fooling yourself. They is not an authority. Past experience does not make me an authority either. That is unquestionable, an authority that does not need to offer you evidence of what I'm saying. There is no evidence that I know of to support that Jesus was an ancestor or descendant, rather, of King David. So I won't ever tell you that, and I'll certainly never say they say that that's so. In the best of circumstances, Rushkoff writes, they can make us feel safe the way parents do. Well, at least most of them. They make our decisions for us. They do our thinking for us. We don't have to worry about our next move. It's already been decided on our behalf and in our best interests, or so we hope. Right. So we hope. But you know, I want something more than hope. I want the influence in my life to be based on evidence that treats my mind as worthy of real engagement. I want influences who respect me for who I am, not simply as a consumer whom they consider, in Rushkoff's analysis, malleable and predictable. I don't want to bow down to what they say or some book says, even if the cover of the book is strikingly attractive, well designed, and the photo of the author downright beguiling. I want truth to be my authority, not some authority to be my truth. I don't want to automatically buy anything just because they think that I'm somebody who can be easily influenced to do or to buy anything. In fact, I have begun to wonder lately, especially when I think of justice issues, justice being the theme for January, if the influences that matter most to me are precisely the ones that at first elicit a flinch from me, a bit of pain, and raise up my resistance like a wall. I think of what Bell Hooks reported when she taught a class in literature and asked the students to look at context as well as text, history as well as story. Bell writes, students stated quite openly and honestly that reading the literature in the context of class discussion was making them feel pain. They complained that everything was changing for them, that they were seeing the world differently and seeing things in that world that were painful to face. Never before had a group of students so openly talked about the way in which learning to see the world critically was causing pain. I did not belittle their pain, nor try to rationalize it. Of course you didn't. No good teacher would either belittle or rationalize something like pain. And I find Bell Hooks to be a mighty fine teacher, personally. Jolinda and Eric and I have taken workshops with her many times at Ohio State, and we have always come away feeling engaged and respected in every way. Her way of teaching influenced all three of us, I dare say, and in a very good way. Not all influences in our lives, after all, are automatically suspect or discreditable. Martin Luther King, whose day we celebrate this weekend, just like us, did not arrive on the scene without being deeply influenced by others first. He certainly lifted up Mahatma Gandhi very often, and Dr. Benjamin Mays, a beloved professor of his at Morehouse College. He also certainly revered Henry David Thoreau's writing on civil disobedience, and he said so often. But what you may not know is that he almost always carried a singular book in his back pocket. Not by Gandhi, not by Thoreau, but a book by the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman, one of the truly great religious figures of the 20th century in the United States, in the world. The book was called Jesus and the Disinherited. And King returned to read that book over and over again, all the time. He chose deliberately to be influenced by Dr. Thurman. There's no question of a sales pitch here or malleability. Yes, it's true, Dr. King did know Dr. Thurman very well. His father had been classmates with him. But that's not why he revered Thurman. Thurman, you see, embodied the ideas he wrote down in his book. He founded, long before the civil rights era began, the Church of the Fellowship of All Peoples back in 1944. It's in San Francisco. It was the first multicultural and multiracial congregation in the whole United States of America. And it's still going very strong. And it was Dr. Thurman who introduced Dr. King to Gandhi's principles of nonviolence. When Thurman himself met Gandhi in person, he asked Gandhi what message he would like for him to bring back to the States. Gandhi said to him, "I wish I had made clear my conviction that nonviolence is the best way to establish justice anywhere on earth." Perhaps, Gandhi mused, the black ministers in your country will be more successful in proclaiming this insight than I have been. It wasn't many years afterward that Thurman let King know what Gandhi had said. And look what happened. But lately I've come to suspect that King revered the book that Thurman wrote, Jesus and the Disinherited, not because he knew him, but rather because it made him feel pain when he read the book and raised his resistance. Thurman, after all, talked freely about the failures of the Christian churches he knew in dealing with the disinherited of this world, the racially segregated, the desperately poor, those without power or privilege. This was deeply painful to King, who, like Thurman, was a liberal Baptist minister who loved the church. The nonviolence reflected in Thurman's book was also painful to King at first. No one is raised with nonviolence in their heart. The word itself almost always raises immediate resistance. What about someone who's attacking your mother, huh? And then there's the always ever famous, but what about Hitler? Dr. King was not born with the idea of nonviolence in his heart any more than Gandhi was. Nor was King bound to only one religious view of the world as a liberal Baptist. Dr. King and Coretta Scott King actually attended Unitarian Universalist congregations back in Boston, where there are many of them, when he was going to school there. He thought that maybe strikingly liberal forms of religion might not exemplify Thurman's critique of the churches, the painful critique. But back in those days, Unitarian Universalism was a bit different than it is now. The Kings found our congregations too blindly optimistic, always imagining that things would just get better by themselves without a struggle. That's mostly changed now. It started during the Civil Rights era. The UUA board itself, when King called religious groups down to Selma, adjourned their meeting in Boston and flew down south in support of King's actions. One of our ministers, James Reeb, lost his life in Selma. And as King said when he offered a eulogy for James Reeb, he sacrificed his life. It's a very strong religious term. And since that time, we have quit thinking that optimism is the only magic that we need, and we have rolled up our sleeves and looked at ourselves and allowed ourselves, I think, to experience the pains of injustice among us and around us, and to let those pains influence us more than either optimism or the hope that things will just get better. I think of bell hooks' classroom again. Later, we discussed the way in which all their comments implied that to experience pain is bad, an indication that something is wrong. We talked about changing how we perceived pain, about our society's approach to pain, considering the possibility that this pain could be a constructive sign of growth. I shared with them my sense that the experience should not be viewed as static, and that they indeed might be led to clarity and a greater sense of well-being by that pain. Can pain be positive? Well, yes, because I now believe that there are useful pains and useless pains, and that they're not the same. I learned this physically when I suffered something called a frozen shoulder a couple of years ago, and my doctor insisted I get physical therapy for it 3 days a week for months and months. The therapist, as she twisted my shoulder back, caused me a lot more pain than I was feeling because of just the frozen shoulder. And I would ask her every time, because it's baffled me so much, why is this pain good and the other pain bad? When I questioned her, she would explain. Every single time I went to her, she would explain biologically why this was true, and that this terrible pain I was feeling, she used to give me pain medication so I wouldn't scream, actually was benefiting me and was leading to health. I have no pain in my shoulder anymore. I can run my arms all over the place. So she was right. Some pain can be a positive influence on our health. And I have to believe it's not just because of something in our bodies, but also that it works the same way in our spirits, in our dreams, and our visions for a just world. Spiritually, a useless pain is what I have experienced all this past week, when an extraordinarily wonderful man, like Dr. King, has been abused so thoroughly as he has been this week. On television, the talking heads, the famous talking heads on TV. They say Dr. King would have been for giving guns to the slaves on the plantations. Or they say King would want to have guns in schools. This is all said. I'm not making this up. They say that Dr. King would have been entirely against Roe versus Wade. Actually, no one actually knows what King's views of abortion were, because he never said one word about it. Not one word. He was, however, the most joyful recipient of the Margaret Sanger Award, because he was so open about family planning and birth control throughout his career, and he spoke about it all the time, as well as about war and economic poverty and so forth. He wasn't just a one-tune singer. He was also a total Gandhian, so saying he would be for guns in schools, or God help us for believing that the slaves should have been given guns, I wonder by who, makes not only little sense, but it's a vile insult to his memory and his life and his positive, justice-grounded influence on the whole of American culture. The pain of my depression that day after New Year's was not a bad pain. It was a good pain, a useful one. I had many good reasons to feel down. There's no reason to deny grief. It's real. I think of it as a tribute, an emotional tribute, if you will, equal in power to the love that I felt for those people that I lost. But I didn't want that pain to define my life for all time. So I was glad that the pain of my depression began to evaporate because a friend asked me to be there for him and his pain. I felt his pain and I went to see him. The pain of Mr. Twain's depression disappeared when people showed up without him even asking. They just knocked at his door. They imagined the pain of his loss. They loved their cats too, and they responded to it. The pains of injustice in this nation will begin to evaporate when people allow themselves to feel and be influenced by the pains of the disinherited. And then, after a time of acknowledging that pain, we too might get out of bed and show up to serve as allies in the establishment of a just society for all, including ourselves. When we are mindful of who influences us, who does influence you, and choose those influences wisely and deliberately, we too might learn to respect our own dreams of justice as much as we quote King's "I Have a Dream" speech. I wonder what kind of influence we would wield then.